Josh, I'm a reporter from Austin. We're working on a story about Jamie Mayberry. Wondered if you might know him.
You can get off my property right now, is what you can do.
I backed off the front porch of the trailer house and tried to remain calm. I guess I was about 50 feet from the car and miles away from anything else. Nothing but the oil fields all around the property.
You have a right to bear arms, and I'm not scared to use them, so get off my property right now.
Two things went through my head. One, this was the woman. The convicted felon a detective had told me just 2 hours earlier he'd exhausted every resource to find with no luck. Yet we tracked her down pretty fast.
Did you know that Kennedy police are looking for you?
Before I use force.
Two, I needed to leave because someone was threatening me. Someone, maybe the only person left, who police say might know what happened to Jamie Mayberry. This is Catalyst, an investigative podcast from KXAN News and Nexstar Media Group. I'm Josh Hinkle. This season is about missing persons in Texas, problems with the systems meant to give the public tools to help solve these cases, the steps police aren't always taking that could bring families closure, and the sudden disappearance of a young man labeled a crossdresser in a town full of secrets.
Is this a case where they just decided to leave? Or was there some foul play in it?
For the past 9 months, I've been working with a team of journalists exploring the challenges families find when seeking answers about their missing loved ones, like Jamie Mayberry.
That could provide small clues that eventually lead to a bigger resolution in this case.
This investigation grew as we talked to families across Texas who all seem to have a common concern, the way police respond to their cases from day one.
That family hurts. It's not okay to leave that case hanging, no matter how long it takes to solve it.
We tracked down witnesses, searchers, law enforcement, people who have never been asked about the Mayberry case before. We pieced together what went wrong and what can still be done for his family and for thousands of others across the state, as our questions prompt police to take a fresh look at old files.
I can't imagine the emotion that those families and the stress that they're going through. Thank God I've never had that tragedy in my life.
As a Texas lawmaker promises to consider a new way of sharing case information faster and more efficiently. Let me tell you how it all started. The name Mayberry was what really caught my attention. Last summer, I was looking through profiles in the Texas Department of Public Safety's online missing persons bulletin for a few days, trying to see if there was a story in the data I was gathering. I wasn't quite sure what I was looking for. Then it popped up. A case in Karnes County, Texas, just southeast of San Antonio. James H. Mayberry, Jr. It immediately felt familiar. Andy Griffith, the old TV show my parents had watched, and I'd seen plenty of times too, about a town with that same name that was almost too good to be true. A place where police and the public lived in half-hour harmony. I guess I'd never met anyone with the last name of Mayberry. Whatever the reason, I stayed on the page. The photo there was black and white, grainy. It looked like a driver's license picture of a black woman with long dark hair, earrings, and a shiny necklace. I kept reading. James H. Mayberry Jr., aka Jamie. Case type, endangered. Last seen in the town of Kennedy, reported missing April 2nd, 1999, just 35 years old. Scrolling down, a short description said, Mr. Mayberry is a crossdresser and usually carries a small brown purse. He was last seen wearing a beige long-sleeve button-down shirt with no collar, khaki shorts, and ladies' white slip-on tennis shoes. I bookmarked the page and left it alone, but not before I sent an open records request to DPS, the state agency behind the information I'd just read. I wanted to know if the 727 cases I could view on the site were all of the active missing persons cases in Texas at the time. A few weeks later, I got a reply. But getting an answer would not be that simple. Apparently, DPS didn't track cases so cleanly. Finding a total number reported by police to the Texas Crime Information Center, TCIC, and in turn, the National Crime Information Center, NCIC, would be tricky, especially if I wanted to know the status of those cases. If I was going to really understand the system, I needed to know how many missing persons were reported, if their cases were still active or had been closed, and how. Was the missing person located? Were they found alive? To speed up the process and understand if I had a story here after all, I ended up narrowing the records I wanted to the past 20 years, everything from 1998 and on. What I got back showed more than a million people had been reported missing to Texas law enforcement in those two decades alone. Today, more than 99% of those cases are listed as cleared. Why? DPS doesn't really know. They don't track it that specifically. It would take asking all of the hundreds of Texas police departments that have reported missing persons to the state individually. Why was each case cleared? Something like that would probably be a long wait, not to mention cost a lot of money. We'd have to pay those agencies for the time and manpower they put into digging up the details. Surely there's an easier way. Shouldn't the state already be doing this? Maybe, but to start, I decided to focus on the cases with the fewest answers, the active ones. 5,628. That's how many missing persons reports are still out there. Unsolved cases. People gone in just that time frame, including Jamie Mayberry.
Before this happened to us, you know, I'd see on TV. You see this stuff all the time. And you're just like, oh man, it's so sad, you know, they're missing, but you don't really know how it feels until it actually happens to you. And until you want answers, until you want closure.
That's Gina Littles, Jamie Mayberry's niece, the last person to see him.
Yes, 20 years has passed, and yeah, we're here now, but there's pieces of our lives that are not closed. It's missing.
On April 1st, 1999, Gina was 18, a senior in high school, and in town visiting her favorite uncle.
What I most remember of that night is before he left. And we had our music on, and we're listening to young music, you know? And I remember some of the songs would come on, and he'd be like, what are they talking about, a scrub? What's the, you know, like, no scrubs. And I would explain, you know, this or that to him, and we'd be laughing, because, and then he'd try to sing like them, and I remember that.
The family has long since moved away from Kennedy. Jamie's disappearance changed everything.
He loved my nieces and nephews. Yeah, they would come over, and Jamie's entertaining them. You know.
Yeah.
Gina drove back to town to meet me a few months before the 20-year anniversary of Jamie going missing. Her other uncle, Terry, joined us. He was just a year younger than Jamie growing up.
He did drama in school. It was the funniest thing you ever want to see. You know, the whole school body showed up for any time he was doing any play in school because he was so electric. He was just so funny, and he said everything at the right time. You know, just made everybody laugh, you know.
He'd give it to you like you think, oh, you're watching a Broadway show, because he was just that good.
He could really did something with that too, I believe.
He was YOLO back then. You know, you only live once, and he lived.
For a small town in rural Texas, he was very open about his lifestyle though.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very open, yeah.
Open to a fault.
What do you mean by that?
Now it's normal. I mean, you have that. But in a small town, they're not used to it. That kind of lifestyle that he lived, being openly gay, I think that kind of was something people frowned upon because you didn't see that all the time. That's why I say YOLO. You know, you only live once. That's he was living. That's him. He stopped being what everybody else wanted him to be. And he lived for himself.
I've seen in some of the police reports that they've labeled him a cross-dresser.
Now, he probably would have been transgender, and he probably would have gotten the surgery, and he would have been a transsexual. Cross-dresser, he looked like a woman.
Yeah.
He looked better than some women.
Yeah, he was what you would call a beautiful...
He was beautiful.
...man or a woman.
He felt like he was a woman, so he was just being himself. This small town was too little for him. Like he dressed and he acted like he belonged in Hollywood or, you know, in New York. You know, I mean, that was just him. I mean, he had his style.
Fashion.
He knew what he, He was always out of the ordinary. He'd find something and be like, oh, I'm going to wear this on my head. And you're like, okay, you know, that looks good. All right. But you wouldn't think to do that. But he always was very eccentric.
Do you ever feel like his lifestyle put him at risk or made him a target for anything?
Oh, absolutely. I remember that was an incident one time that me and Jamie were at a club in San Antonio, and he was so used to going into the women's restrooms. And I remember I told him, I said, here, you can't do that. You know, there's girls with their boyfriends standing outside. They see you go in there, it's gonna be, you know, and I was somewhere and he had went to the restroom and I just thought about it. I heard some commotion way down. It was a pretty big club and I heard some commotion kind of in the back. So I just curiosity, I got up and I went to go see what it was. And sure enough, the guy's yelling, you know, there's a guy in the restroom. So, you know, I had to get him out of there and they were getting pretty hostile. So things like that where he was, you know, clashing with society. And I told him it was, you know, don't do that, it's dangerous. Because he just didn't quite understand why not.
Because I think he felt like people would understand where he was coming from, that he was a woman, that he felt like he was a woman. Right. But when we would try to talk to him and tell him, like, the world, they don't feel the way, I mean, they're not ready for that right now. Like, they're not gonna accept and embrace that yet. They're not there yet. So you still being a man with male body parts, going into a female's restroom, there's gonna be an issue. But to him, it's like, I don't get it. I don't understand where y'all are coming from when I am a woman.
Then you go into him wanting to have somebody. Okay, so if you look at it in his point of view, and it took me a long time to understand that, but in his point of view, he didn't want another transgender or another gay or lesbian person. He wanted someone, he wanted to be treated
like a woman.
Like he's a woman, because he got good at it. Well, you couldn't even tell that he was a man. Once again, I told him I thought that was pretty dangerous, because I said, now you're deceiving someone, because he wouldn't tell him.
That's when the conversation turned darker. All this time later, Gina and Terry were still really sad and angry. You could see it on their faces.
But there was a guy that was from a
Chicago.
Different, yeah, and he came down and he was interested in my uncle. We'd never seen him before.
Gina told me about the night before Jamie went missing. They'd gone out to a bar in downtown Kennedy.
You were at a bar when you were 18?
Mm-hmm. Oh, in Kennedy?
I was probably at a bar before I was 18. Yeah. I mean, we used to go. I mean, around here, especially in the small towns, you would go and we'd pay the jukebox. And that's it. We'd stay out of grown people's way. But, you know, we were there. I mean, I was 18. I didn't drink or anything, but I went.
Jamie came in and he sat down with some other people that he knew. They had a cousin that came from Chicago. He started hitting on Jamie pretty much the whole night. And once the cousin told him, you know that's a guy, he pulled out a knife and my brother got up and took off.
So Jamie and Gina left the bar, but the story didn't stop there. The next night, remember the night when they were listening to music and having fun at home? Gina said it was sometime after 11.
And then there was a knock at the door, but I went to the restroom. And it was a guy at the door, and he was like, hey, Jamie, you remember me? And then he asked him if he wanted to go and get some beers and just have, you know, maybe a couple beers with him, and then he'd bring him back. Because Uncle Jamie kept saying, well, my niece is here, you know, and I'm spending time with my niece. And the guy was like, well, we'll just have a beer. And then we'll bring you back, you know, we'll bring you back. And he was like, all right, you know, but that's all I heard. Cause I could just hear like the little bits and pieces. And so he left. When I walked out of the restroom, I looked out the window and I saw a truck. And then they were gone. And then he just didn't come home.
Did you see the guy at all?
No, I saw the truck leaving when I walked out of the restroom and looked through the window.
You heard his voice?
Mm-hmm.
What'd it sound like?
A Hispanic male, because they had like a Mexican accent. I saw headlights, just a truck backing out and leaving. I didn't get to see who was in there. It was dark.
When did you first realize that he wasn't coming home?
After a few hours passed, and then there was two guys that came to the door and knocked on the door. And I opened the door. And I remember just locking that screen real quick, like as soon as I had opened it, because I thought it was Uncle Jamie. So when I seen the guys, I was like, oh my God, and I was so quick, thank God. And I locked the door, and then I closed the big one, and I locked it, and the guys were like, is your Uncle Jamie here? And I was like, no, he's not. And then I lied and said everyone was there. I told them my mom and dad, you know, my uncles and aunts were there, you know. I was like, oh, but everyone's asleep. Wow. You know, I said that because I didn't want them to think I was there by myself. It just seemed fishy. Like, it seemed for them to come ask where he was at in the middle of the night, and it just seemed like they knew too, because they kind of laughed.
It's something that still scares Gina today. She's convinced her uncle knew something was up and left to keep her out of trouble. But what about those guys who showed up later? She's not sure, but thinks maybe they stopped by to play dumb, to make it seem like no one did anything to Jamie, to sort of throw off the narrative.
Because I mean, I really didn't go to sleep. He wasn't there, and he would never do that. So I remember the next morning, I ran to the payphone, and I called my mom, and I called everybody, and then she called everybody, and then everyone came. And we ended up calling the law enforcement at that time, and they came to the house. And we told them, and at first they were saying that he just wanted to leave.
It was Kennedy police?
It was Kennedy police.
And they told you that he just wanted to leave?
Yeah, they were like, well, how do y'all know he's missing? I mean, he's an adult. He may have wanted to go. He may have went to go visit somebody or, you know, and we're like, he doesn't do this. Especially with me being there, he wouldn't have done that.
In your opinion, did they take it serious enough right there?
No.
Oh, I'll tell you right now, they didn't. When I got here, I talked to a police officer, and he told me in my face that, Terry, I know Jamie, and he would always tell me that he can't wait to get out of this place. So he's probably gone. Y'all need to just chill out.
But the Mayberries didn't chill out. Not then, not today. They're still demanding answers, unwilling to accept Jamie would just walk out. I wasn't ready to leave either, so for the next week, Kennedy became my home. Coming up this season on Catalyst.
NAMIS is the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. The program is operated here in Fort Worth.
We've had family members of missing persons come into the NAMIS database, search through the unidentified decedents, and essentially solve their own cases.
We're a state that doesn't require law enforcement to participate in NAMIS. If I thought that we were not participating in a meaningful manner, then I think it would be necessary for us to pass legislation.
It was pretty much we were looking for a deceased body.
There's another mention of an old cemetery.
This is where everyone who was on the search team would sign?
Yes, if everyone was there, which sometimes becomes very important.
And that was a time someone changed our direction. And I even got suspicious of that.
Reading the reports, I didn't get the impression that they didn't take it seriously. Yeah, I'm assuming they did what they could do. And then when they reached a certain level or they needed more assistance, you know, the Rangers.
I wouldn't get called immediately unless there was something, you know, really obviously wrong at the scene or something.
Would you have done anything differently with the investigation yourself if you had been in charge of it?
I think knowing what I know now, probably, especially when you ask the tough question, you know, point blank. You want to see the reaction.
I want someone to come in and pick the case back up. And it's not just important to our family, it's important for there to be justice in this town.